Okay, so welcome back. This is the second part of the sixth and final class. It's not absolutely final because we have four TD after Christmas, which are actually programmed for the aggregation and down, but the extern are invited as well. And those all will be around text commentaries on this question. It's around March, sometime in March, almost exactly at them, just before the 10 classes finish. Okay, and that's good. November 1977. In November, there's a strike by the firefighters. Although, again, I'm being very modern there. We called them at the time the firemen. They were on their first ever national strike in the hope of getting a 30% wage increase, and there were almost 100% of the firemen on strike, and the army was brought in to provide emergency cover. And British Airways began a regular London to New York City supersonic Concorde service. It's a very interesting story, is Concorde, you know, because you could get from London to New York in 3 hours. And you might think that that somebody would still want to do that, but apparently not. You know, nobody's tried to do it again.
Yeah. Yes, they're trying at the moment.
Oh, are they? Really? Yes. Oh, that's interesting.
Less noisy. And
that will do this 3 hours. Yeah. Oh, that's it. That's an interesting idea, because it's true that, you know...
Two days ago.
Oh, that's interesting. Because you think normally, you know, I mean, there's a six-hour time difference. So does it matter if you get there in 3 hours or in 6 hours? You know, you think that, especially today, because if you're rich, you have the internet on the plane, you have everything you need, you know.
The Americans
are doing it. Oh, that's interesting.
It was never profitable. It was an ecological disaster.
That's true, but that often doesn't stop people. it's good. It would be good if everybody asked your opinion before they invented things, but yeah, no, they don't. Yeah. In popular culture in 1977, a new film was released, Saturday Night Fever, with John Travolta. Do you know this film? It's still quite well known, isn't it? That's again a great success, really, to be still known such a long time afterwards. Starring John Travolta as a working class man who is king of the dance floor at weekends. The plot tells of racial tension and religious influence in working class America, with the songs of the Bee Gees in homage to disco music and dancing. Another Nobel Prize in December 1977, Francis Mott won the Nobel Prize in Physics. And I know I'm repeating myself, but I'm quite impressed with this number of Nobel Prizes. Now, this is also the time that Star Wars was shown in British cinemas for the first time, beginning, of course, with Episode 4. Yes, it was episode 1 at the time, and then it became episode 4, although now maybe 5 if you count Rogue One. But there you go. It gets complicated. Undated events of 1977. Golden Wonder launched pot noodles. Now, pot noodles are these little things in plastic with c'est des nouilles, now, that might seem completely anecdotal, but it was very shocking at the time, that kind of very fast food, ultra-fast food. There's no microwaves, of course, at the time. And even today, in 2016, in their factory in Wales, they produce 175 million of them a year. That was a real British success, the pot noodles. I'm not sure if I'm really proud of it there. In the 1970s, it was felt to be typical of a student population. This is still at some. Remember, people don't have freezers. Very few people have freezers, and so, you know, fast food is tinned food at the time, and there's a lot more people, a lot more women cooking than there are today. And for the first time in 1977, colour televisions outnumbered black and white televisions. And there's only one publication I'm noted for 1977, which is Marilyn French's feminist novel, an American feminist novel, The Women's Room. This influential feminist novel by an American author, whose first book had been a thesis on James Joyce, followed the lives of a group of housewives, middle-class housewives, in 1950s and 1960s America, who were gradually realizing how limited their lives were because of the rigid expectations imposed upon women. This novel eventually sold over 20 million copies. It was it's been translated into French under the title Toilette des femmes. Il y a 10 ans, c'était un peu connu, et aujourd'hui, moi, à nouveau. I do recommend it. It really is pretty good. I read it in 1979, when I knew nothing about feminism.
The Women's Room.
It might not be the right year to read it, but when you have time, you know, it's... 1978, some statistics for 1978. In 1978, 28% of all workers in Britain worked in manufacturing industry, in factories, making things. 28%. In 2009, c'est les chiffres que j'ai, this figure was only, anybody?
10%.
Exactly 10%. Yeah. So that is to say that from 1978 to 2009, that's 30 years, from 28 to 10. Yeah, so there's huge changes going on towards the service industry. Now, the service industry is, of course, hotels and restaurants, but it's also insurance and banking. And insurance is big business. London is the biggest insurance capital of the world. There are hundreds of thousands of people working in insurance in London. And in 1978, there were 13 million trade union members. This is the highest point. In January 1978, the European Court of Human Rights found the United Kingdom government guilty of mistreating prisoners in Northern Ireland, in particular using sensory deprivation, that is, silence and dock, for weeks on end. And Margaret Thatcher made a very important speech, and a very unusual speech, in a television interview. She said, because of immigration, many Britons fear being, I quote, swamped by people with a different culture. Have you heard of this speech yet? Very, very famous speech. So first of all, notice the vocabulary, swamped, englouti, dans un marécage. Yeah, it's a very, very negative, review. Also gives the impression of a flood of immigrants coming in and swamping you. Now, this was fascinating because before this, no party leader had ever said anything like this. So Enoch Powell would always been on the extreme wing of his party, and this was probably an opportunistic. Speech. It's certainly true that in the short term, in the following 2 weeks, the rating of the Conservative Party in the poll went up. Very, very, very clear. Interesting also, though, is that she made this kind of speech once and never again. Why not? I don't know. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but there was something problematic about it for her, I think. I mean, politically, I don't mean morally. I don't mean ethically. I know nothing about that. So it's much, much contrast. Thatcher's speech came in a context in which neo-fascist organisations such as the National Front were gaining support and receiving high votes in local elections. So it was seen as an opportunistic attempt to play the race card. In the medium term, it's difficult to know exactly what the effect was, but certainly in the short term, it gained support. Okay, there are two or three of the videos in my list of videos that go around this question. This is also the time where Scottish nationalism comes back into the news because there is the Scotland Bill. Now, of course, the Scotland Bill is not the Scotland Act. The Scotland Bill is being debated in Parliament. And a fateful amendment is passed. Does anybody know about this fateful amendment?
Yeah, I think for a referendum, they needed certain 40% of all Scots had to vote.
Right, yes.
Otherwise, it wouldn't count.
Right, exactly. So the plan had been, the Labour Party had promised a referendum about an autonomous parliament in Edinburgh like there is today. This amendment said, yes, but we're not happy if there's 51% for an assembly. If most people stay at home, we're not happy. So the vote will only be valid if it is not only more than 50% of voters, but more than 40% of the electorates. Yeah, not all Scots, the babies don't count, but yes. So basically, if too many people stay at home, it doesn't count. This is first of all, from a democratic point of view, this is always something which is debated forever. You know, what do you do with people who stay at home? You can say les absents ont toujours tort. That's one possibility. And on the other hand, you get arguments like in France, where people would like there to be a recognition for a blank ballot. So all sorts of things going on. And right this week, of course, in Catalonia, the question of what that matter, what when you have a 43% turnout and a 90% yes vote, what does that mean politically? It's a political minefield, and the reason that it was so fateful is because that's exactly what happened. They got more than 50% of voters, but less than 40% of the electorate. So not only, and we'll tell you in a moment, not only was there no Scottish Parliament, but the Scottish Nationalists were furious because they got more than 50% of the votes, and they obviously didn't like this amendment. In February 1978, the first episode of the BBC One television series Grange Hill, about everyday life in a comprehensive school, was broadcast. It was to continue broadcasting new series for 30 years. Very British. And it was considered to be rather daring, in that some social questions of working class young people in school were put on the it was very popular among young people. I never really watched it myself, but I was a bit old. This is also the time when the BBC Radio produced the comic science fiction series The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, starring a confused suburban man and a manic depressive robot. The series broke new ground in absurd humour. I'm not sure if you will understand this, I can't really translate it. One of its more memorable dialogues: "What is it like going through this machine?" "Oh, it's a bit like being drunk." "That doesn't sound so bad." "You ask a glass of water." There you go. Okay. There you go. April 1978, on the changes in social mores, the first official nudist beach in Britain was open in Brighton after a debate in the Conservative-dominated local council. One of the Conservative opponents said, "It distresses me to think that people naively think that what is good for the continent is good for Britain." So it was all the fault of the French, of course, that they were having the first nudist speech in Britain. We also opened up, in April 1978, radio broadcasts of all debates in the House of Commons. This was an important reform, and it was long debates before it was agreed, and this is something which will continue even after the 70s. A more open attitude to public information, leading up to under Tony Blair and I think 2000, the Freedom of Information Act, on an American model. The Freedom of Information Act means that if a public organisation has information and you want it, they must give it you unless they have a good reason. So, for example, if we go back to the same hospital, let's imagine you think that the managing committee are racists. You could write to the hospital and say, "I want the minutes of all your meetings for the last year," and they must give them to you. Unless they can show, well, it's dangerous, or they take out the medical secrets or something like that. Yeah, that there is an assumed right to information. This is very modern for Britain. very modern indeed for Britain. And I think that broadcasting the House of Commons debates is a first sort of step to that kind of thing.
What was the name of the science fiction series?
Oh, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And if you ask, oh, I don't know the general final answer, a British people will always answer 42, because in the Hitchhiker, that's the final answer. In the answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything is 42. And you had to be there. Okay. Reforms to the pension schemes. A new way of calculating retirement pensions is introduced, the State Earnings Related Pension Scheme. So this is organised by the government. Notice that we don't have a separate Caisse de Sécurité Sociale in Britain. This is very important politically, because this means you can't have a trou de la sécu, because there isn't a separate budget. It's just government money. Taxes coming in, money going out for different things, including social services. So it makes a political difference. And at this moment, this is a moment when it is a supplementary pension organised by the government, earnings related. And let's say that it's that probably the last moment or the highest moment where government organisation of pensions is at its highest point. Over the 80s and 90s and 2000s, that Britain will go much further than France in privatising pensions. And indeed today, if you're somebody about my age in Britain, you can sell your state pension. That is, that you have a state pension, you can ask for the money now, £20,000, or I don't know, a lump sum. And neoliberal governments have been successful in persuading or making most people to see pensions as a private individual initiative. That you want a good pension when you're old, so you make sure you have money to invest in order to have a reasonable pension, and the government responsibility is just to the minimum VES. It's just the minimum thing. So it's part of what's happening in the 70s here is much more a welfare state approach, which will fade away, especially in pensions, over the next 30 or 40 years, just in a similar way as in higher education. It's been established in Britain today that if you want a university education, this is seen by the government as an individual investment. You want a university education so you can get more money, and so you should pay for it. And that's the neoliberal justification behind the very high tuition fees. Now, to make this possible in Britain, they had to organise government loans. Yeah, they were. It was politically impossible to just say, "Oh well, if you don't have any money, that's your problem. Go and see if a bank will lend you the money," because of course the banks only don't lend to poor people. And so, in the 1990s, when they introduced this, they introduced government student loans, which is basically the bank lends you the money, guaranteed by the government, and you only pay back once you earn more than 1.6% or six times the minimum wage or something. So it's still you have to pay it back, but in theory, even if you're poor, you can get the loan. Yeah, this is later on. Yeah, but it's all part of a similar thing. This time, April 1978, is also the time of the big Rock Against Racism and Anti-Nazi League Carnival. The Anti-Nazi League and the Rock Against Racism organised an anti-racist march, followed by a series of concerts in Victoria Park. The organisers claimed 100,000 people came to listen to The Clash, The Ruts, Sham 69, Steel Pulse, etc. Now, this is a particularly innovative and large-scale musical and political phenomenon in the 1970s, the emergence of Rock Against Racism. The spark was the reaction by a group of left-wingers to Eric Clapton, who at a concert in Birmingham gave a long racist speech saying Enoch Powell was right and we need to send all the blacks out of this country, except that he didn't say blacks. And he went on for hours, apparently. And the result was that a couple of left-wingers wrote a letter to the music newspaper and said, we want to set up a Rock Against Racism. It was a completely new idea. They'd invented it. And it was a tremendous success. And over the next few years, they had hundreds of concerts around the country. Always the same formula. White punk group, because all the punk groups were white except one. Black reggae group, because all the black groups were reggae except one. On the same bill, the black group at the top of the bill, and at the end of the concert, one song where the two groups sang together, Rock Against Racism. The aim was to make racism uncool. This is something that's difficult to measure, but I know a number of people who told me that around them, racism became suddenly uncool, because you know rock and roll seemed to be against racism. Also, it simply mixed publics together, because even anti-racist white people didn't go to reggae concerts, because white people went to punk concerts and black people went to reggae concerts. Not because, you know, it was just like automatic sort of segregation. And so to get them together was something very creative and innovative. The same month was the eighth and last National Women's Liberation Conference in Birmingham. The first one was 1970. The last one was 1978. This was a sign of a very dynamic movement, a national conference every year. And the debates were very, very wide-ranging and fiery and sparky. And after this one, it collapsed, and there has not been another one since. Now, that doesn't mean that all the different women's liberation campaigns collapsed. People continued doing the very, very varied things they wanted to do, encouraging women's writing, or establishing refuges for victims of domestic violence, or working for equal pay, or working the Labour Party to change policies, and 100 things. But the national movement actually collapsed. Now, why did it collapse? Well, basically, the divisions at the conference between, on the one hand, Marxist feminists, who felt that capitalism was at the root of the supposed need for unpaid domestic work and for division between men and women. And so, for these Marxist feminists, a united working class was the best way to get rid of women's oppression. And on the other hand, radical feminists who felt that patriarchy was the central dynamic of society and that working class men benefited from women's oppression and so would not play a role in combating it. Now, of course, in any movement you always have different perspectives, but it seemed that in this movement the different perspectives didn't find a way of continuing to work together on some things when they disagreed on another. And apparently it was explosive. Nobody dared organise another one after it. So it must have been pretty something. Interestingly enough, recently the British Library in London has put online the entire archives of Spare Rib, which is which was the most influential feminist magazine from the 1970s. It's impossible to point to a typical 1970s activist for women's liberation. Some were working in trade unions, some inside the Labour Party, some were revolutionaries, some were organising Reclaim the Night marches. This is where women's marches would march around the centre of Manchester at night to protest about the fact that it's not safe for women at night, etc. Many, 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 many others. Going on too. In May 1978, the Liberal Party leader, David Steele, announced that the Lib Lab Pact was to be dissolved, leaving Mr. Callaghan without a majority in the House of Commons. It all went very smoothly. They politely announced together that they weren't going to have an alliance anymore. It was all very polite, all very, very, very courteous. So this meant, of course, that the Labour Party could no longer guarantee that it would win every vote of confidence. And so the question began to be, when will there be the election? When will the election be? Now, it was already in May. So that means what the question was, will there be an election in September or October? Because, June is too near the holidays and et cetera. Yeah. Traditionally, May and October are the, the favourite months. In the winter, nobody wants to leave their house to go and vote. And in the summer, everybody's thinking about the holidays. I think that's the up and down of it. Media commentators were convinced that a general election would be held in the autumn, as the minority government led by James Callaghan was only surviving with some difficulty. And Callaghan's chances of an election success looked considerably better than they had for some months previously, according to opinion polls. We will come back to that in just a moment. So this the tension is rising about the Labour government. Je vous la mèche rapidement pour pouvoir tout mettre ensemble. James Callaghan could have called an election in the autumn of 1978. All his friends said he should, but he didn't. If he had, he would have had a fairly good chance of winning. And if he'd won, Margaret Thatcher would have had a fairly good chance of resigning as leader of the Labour Party, the Conservative Party. But this is la politique fiction, bien sûr. Why didn't he call an election in the autumn of 1978? It seems to be that although he thought it was possible to win, there was a real risk of winning just enough to continue with a minority government or one or two, and he was just exhausted. You know, it was very, very, it was physically exhausting to be a minority government. So that seems to be the main reason. However, it turned out badly for him because the winter of 1978 to 1979 has since become famous for a misquote from Shakespeare as the winter of discontent. The original quote being, "Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York." It has nothing to do with it, but anyway, the winter of discontent, which is a tremendously important event. I'll be saying a little more about it, but let me give a basic introduction now. It's a series of strikes, mostly in the public sector. It was due to the fact that it was a clear fact that many workers had lost buying power. The agreements that the trade unions had made to limit wage rises had led to a reduction in real wages because prices were rising higher. So that was the reason behind it. The reason it took a little time is that many, many trade unionists considered the Labour Party to be their government. And for a couple of years, trade union leaders could say, I know you're unhappy, but you know, a Conservative government would be worse for trade unionists. So just be patient a little longer. So when it exploded, it really did explode. So the winter of discontent is very new in a number of ways. First of all, it's mostly public sector strikes against a Labour government for the first time. There have been smaller public sector strikes against Labour governments in the past, but the first time, and so that made it rather contradictory because, you know, the trade unions invented the Labour Party and generally support the Labour Party as a majority. The Labour Party gets its money from the trade unions. But I think it also got to a point where the trade union leaders could no longer persuade their members, and the trade union leaders will prefer to organise a strike than to have a strike explode without them having any control of it. Remember that the trade union leaders are an intermediate social layer. That is to say, they're very different in the 1970s from today. Today, a national trade union leader can earn £150,000 a year. Yeah. Like, let's say, 20 times more than his members. They are well, very, very well paid. This was not the case in the 90s. It's not the case in France. They can't get away with it. In fact, in the British trade unionist movement today, it's considered that the trade union national leader should be paid a similar wage to the top managers who he's talking to. Yeah, this was not the case in the 1970s. But even in the 1970s, it's an intermediate layer in the sense that, you know, if you take, the miners' leader, if the miners go on strike and win, what difference does this make to the trade union leader's wages? None. If the miners go on strike and lose, what difference does this make to the trade union? None. So they're not workers. And obviously they're not bosses. They're in between the two. They're professional negotiators. So they hate it when the employer imposes something without a discussion, and they hate it when the rank and file explode and into it, have a big strike without asking them. They are professional negotiators. And so they sometimes react in ways that would be a little surprise, which can be surprising if you don't remember that they're professional negotiators, and that's always what they have to do. Because as the old scholar said, existence determines consciousness. How you live creates what you have in your head. So the winter of discontent will then, of course, at the beginning, a lot of people are rather angry with the strikers, but after a couple of months, a lot of people are angry with the government. This is very typical. And so it's certainly conceivable to think that the winter of discontent made that difference of 3 or 4%, which meant that Margaret Thatcher won the following election. Again, you need to remember the contradictory side of it, because the very simplistic side of this, which I'm sure you would never do, but you must make sure you don't give the impression that you think that, oh, the English were all Labour. And then in 1979, suddenly they were all Conservative, you know, which is just absolutely nuts. But that's how journalists write about politics, you know. Yeah, Britain is now Conservative, then Britain is now Labour. It means nothing at all. It's that things have changed, you know, that the balance of forces has changed. Let's go back to June 1978. A gunfight between the Provisional IRA and British soldiers left three men dead. And in popular culture, the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical Evita, biographical story about an Argentinian political leader, opened in London. It ran for 7 years and was the beginning of the golden age of London musical comedy. For 10 years, London shows, from 78 to 88, London shows were the most popular in the world, and very often began in London and then moved on to Broadway. So us Britons were very proud of this, because, you know, obviously in cinema this is not the case. Obviously America is so far ahead, so we were pleased to be in here of this. There was also a terrible train fire in July 1978 in the Taunton. A sleeping car caught fire and 12 people were killed. Also in July, the first ever human being born from in vitro fertilization, Louise Brown, was born in Lancashire. Again, an anecdote, except that, you know, it's still a time when the world leaders in new technology could sometimes be in Britain. Could sometimes be in Britain. It's in September 1978 that the Prime Minister, James Callaghan, announces that he will not call a general election for the autumn. And rather bizarrely, he announces it by singing a music hall song at a meeting. It's tremendously bizarre. I think you can probably see it in one of the videos about James Callaghan shows him singing it. This decision is a controversial one. And was taken in spite of many opinion polls that showing that Labour could win. A big strike in September 1978 is reputed to have been the beginning of the winter of discontent. Now, of course, the winter of discontent is a journalistic invention. It's a series of strikes which, at the first strike, nobody said, oh, this will last all winter. And at last, people just, oh, that's finished now, you know, but nevertheless, it's a big wave of strikes. This is normal. Strikes always come in waves. If you look at France in the 1960s, you get the level of strikes at, 63, 64, 65, 67. 68 goes right through the roof. There are more strikes in 68 than the 20 years previously altogether. This is a normal thing for strikes to do. In any case, 72,000 workers at Ford came out on strike. Well, this is where you see that, you know, 28% of the country, of the workers working factories. So you've got 72,000 workers come out and strike at one company, Ford. You know, these are huge companies. Today, car makers in Britain have far fewer workers. They make just as many cars. They just have more machines to do it. After more than 2 weeks on strike, they win a wage rise of 17%. Inflation is still around 14%, so, you know. But of course, this encouraged people tremendously because, oh, hey, the Ford workers, they got 17%, that's not so bad. The other interesting thing about this strike is that the trade union leadership did not support the strike at the beginning. They only supported it after 2 weeks. So it seems that we're in this situation where the trade union leaders are still trying to agree with the government, yeah? So, well, you know, we're not very happy, but, you know, it's a Labour government. We don't want a Conservative government, so... But when they have 72,000 workers, and they refuse to support the strike, and the strike does not collapse, because, you know, it could have lasted 3 days and collapsed, and then... So it's not easy to go on strike for 2 weeks. You know, you don't have any money. You know, it's... seems to be a sign, this not supporting for the first 2 weeks seems to be a sign of tension between the rank and file and the trade union leaders, and this is something which will lead them to change their situation. And this Ford conflict has often been seen as the beginning of the winter of discontent, even though it was in the private sector, and the public sector workers have generally been seen as being, at the heart of the discontent. In October 1978, the government announced plans for a new single exam to replace the previous exams taken at 16 years old. Previously, there were O levels, that is to say, ordinary levels, which were more prestigious and higher level, mostly taken in grammar schools previously, whereas the certificate of secondary education was a lower level exam. Now, in the 60s, in the grammar schools they took O levels, and in the secondary modern schools they took CSEs. And now in the 70s it's in the same school, comprehensive schools, so it no longer seemed logical to have separate sorts of exams, and so they merged them together to make the GCSEs, which I think still exist today. So it's been quite a successful thing. Just like the previous system, this remains a unitary system, that unlike the system in France where you have your back or you don't have your back, in Britain, you decide at 16 years old to take 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 subjects, and you receive a diploma for each one. Yeah. So you can perfectly easily say, and it happens all the time, that people say, oh, I know, I'm really bad at history, I'm not going to take history, I'm going to just take the other ones. Whereas in France, it's the whole thing. Yeah. Now, people often say, well, why don't the English do like the French? And the answer, of course, is because they're French. Okay. Let's say there are advantages and disadvantages to the two systems. But certainly the baccalauréat is this idea of a general level of education, which doesn't exist as much in Britain as an idea. And in France, I'm also very impressed by the way that people say, what did you do? What did your mother do as an education? And people will say, bac plus quatre. And you can't even think this in British, in the British culture. It appears to British people, excuse me, to be stupid, because you could spend 4 years studying music or nuclear physics. They can't just be equivalent, But anyway, that's the way we see it. In any case, that's how it works. In Liverpool, the Anglican Cathedral was completed, the fifth largest cathedral in the world. The construction was begun in 1904 and finished in 1978. So this is not a record, of course, because the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona is still not finished, and they began in the 1920s. So this is not a record. They're the winners there. Another country gains its independence from the United Kingdom. And I remember I pronounced it last year wrongly, and I can't remember now. I think it's Dominica. I'm pretty sure it's Dominica. I know somebody who comes from there, and she always tells me off for pronouncing it wrong. I'm pretty sure it's Dominica. And it won its independence in 1978. So there's still significant colonies winning their independence. Two items in the history of racism. A 12-month investigation by the Commission of Racial Equality ended in a Birmingham nightclub being obliged to lift its ban on black and Chinese customers. And that shows a few things. First of all, it shows how difficult, how ineffective the Commission for Racial Equality was. It took them a year to prove that they didn't let black or Chinese people into the nightclub, you know. I remember that the situation in France changed very about 15 years ago, when for the first, maybe you've heard of this, but in France today, if you suspect that a nightclub is discriminating, you can go along, get a group of black people, and have somebody taking notes. You can deliberately test it. And you can show in court, this is proof in court. 20 years ago, this was not the case. You couldn't use that information in tribunals. So that was the important difference. I don't know what the legal situation was in Britain there. But that's a sign both that it could be done and that it was done in this particular situation. And in the same month, at 22 years of age, Viv Anderson became England's first black international footballer playing for England. This was a challenging position. He could still find himself with racist chants by football crowds. No fun at all. You know, it's bad enough being insulted in the streets, but you know, when you've got 50,000 footballers chanting extremely rude things at you, it could be extremely hard. And also in 1978, Nobel Prize for Chemistry for a reason which I don't understand. And the Labour government survived one more vote of confidence. So we've got to the end of the 1978, and in fact the winter of discontent is mostly January. Huh? The Prime Minister decided not to call his election, and I think it would be fair enough if you're writing about election to remind your readers that in the 1970s, unlike today, the Prime Minister can have an election when they like. Today they have special reasons. The Fixed Term Parliament Act of 2011 made this the case. Today, basically, the Prime Minister can have an election if both big parties agree, because they need two-thirds, and you can't get two-thirds without the other big party. Now, at the moment, it would be very easy for Theresa May to have an election, because the Labour Party have been saying, have an election for the last 6 months, so they can't say no if she suggests it. It's politically impossible. But she does want one. Inflation fell to a six-year low of 8.3%. And so, as we know, the Callaghan government is shortly to be finished, and they will be able, with some reason, say, oh, well, inflation went down a lot when we were in government. They will claim that as a victory. It's something which is a little difficult to analyse, because why does inflation go up and down? I mean, I wish I knew. But, you know, it's Sidibon Gerd saying, hey, it went down a lot while we were in office, and so there we go. However, at the same time, unemployment hits a post-war record of 1.5 million. It can be rather difficult to compare unemployment figures, because the government regularly changes the way that they calculate it. Not unreasonably. I mean, you know, if somebody works 2 days in a month, are they unemployed or not unemployed? 3, 7, 10? You know, there is a certain amount of discussion to be had. And of course, it's in the government's interest to have a low number. So that's true, too. As a sign of the difficult situation of British industry, the motorcycle manufacturer Norton Villiers Triumph, who were a very, very well-known motorcycle company, they went bankrupt and they were liquidated. The British car manufacturer Chrysler sell all its factories to Peugeot. We were very sad, yeah, to sell it all to the French. Okay, and so we're moving into our last year. This is 1979. And immediately in 1979, tens of thousands of public sector workers in many different areas went on strike in what became known as the Winter of Discontent. At this time, the media were very hostile to the Labour government. And indeed, throughout the 1970s, you have the vast majority of the daily newspapers are conservative. There is only The Guardian among the intellectual papers, which is Labour, and The Daily Mirror, which is Labour. Whereas conservative newspapers, you have, and most of them survived until today, The Sun, The Daily Mail, The Daily Express. The Times was more neutral in the 1970s. Today it's conservative. Quite a lot of the Daily Telegraph. The vast majority of the newspapers were in favour, were against the Labour Party, so this will show in the coverage of the strikes, which are extremely hostile, notably that they will try to underline certain aspects. For example, among the many public sector strikes, there was a number of gravediggers in Liverpool who joined in a strike, and so for a few days you couldn't have a burial. Now, of course, this actually meant that the bodies were in the freezer, but the newspapers decided this would make very, very good headlines. And one of the tabloid newspapers, I can't remember which one, had on the front page, "They won't even let us bury our dead." So you can see the sort of sensationalist, emotional interventions of the media, which certainly had an effect. And the other one, which is very famous, is that Prime Minister James Callaghan returned from an international summit to Britain in a state of industrial unrest. And the Sun newspaper reported his comments on the front page with a famous headline, "Crisis? What crisis?" Now, as perhaps you can imagine, James Callaghan never said this. He said, I think people have been exaggerating the crisis, something like that, yeah? But the Sun put, "Crisis, what crisis?" And that was really tremendously effective journalism, not, in my opinion, very honest journalism, but very effective journalism, to such an extent that, as you know, one of the books, one of the most popular books today on the 1970s by Alwyn Turner is entitled "Crisis, what crisis?" This is the one which, of course, you may read if you wish, but which I didn't recommend because there was so much popular culture in it, you know, so much in the 1970s adverts, 1970s television programs, that it's really hard for French people to understand. You know, it's written for people like me, old people being nostalgic about the 70s because we were younger and cuter at the time. Okay, not a lot, but a bit. Okay, so this is the winter of discontent, and will certainly have an effect. I think it will. The government will lose some popularity because of it. In the popular music area, Sid Vicious, the former Sex Pistols guitarist, was found dead in New York as a result of a heroin overdose. At the time, he was on bail, accused of the murder of his girlfriend, who had been found stabbed to death in a hotel room. Yeah, let's say that there was all the information that people who hated punk could use to show that it was all about heroin and murder. In February, the winter of discontent had ended with an agreement on February the 14th between the Trade Union Congress and the government, known as the St. Valentine's Day Agreement. So it was all finished on February the 14th, but this may have been too late. The government had lost some popularity there. And governments lose popularity anyway over a longer period of time. You know, this is now the 5 years the Labour have been in, and a whole load of people in the middle say, "Oh, well, let's give the other lot a chance." You know, it's not always very ideological, actually. It's, "Oh, I'll give the other lot a chance." It's quite an important part. But I think perhaps more in the 1970s than today, my impression is that people were less informed. Not just because of Google, although it's very difficult to measure the effect of Google, but I think it does have an important effect, you know, that you just say, "Oh, I can't remember. What was Mélenchon suggesting on that? Oh, I'll just check," you know. And it's like life before Google. So, I'll never know that. Yeah. I'm sure some of you can remember it. Can you remember life before Google? Not really. Yes, you can. Good. That's good. You're the last generation who will remember life before Google, you know. You remember anything. Well, you don't need to remember anymore. You can find it by Google. March 1979, then the Scottish devolution referendum was held. Scotland voted by a majority of 77,000 in favour of a Scottish Assembly, but I already told you, the decision was not implemented due to a condition that at least 40% of the electorate must support the proposal. In short, too many people stayed at home for the devolutionists to win an effective victory. And this will be... Well, I wouldn't like to be over melodramatic about this, but from the point of view of the Scottish nationalists, this was mid-19th century. Do you know the expression, mid-19th century? From the point of view of the left and democracy, 1933 was considered to be mid-19th century, with the election of Hitler, which is more melodramatic than the Scottish National Party losing their referendum. But yeah, in the 1970s, the Scottish nationalism was growing, it was widening, it was broadening, and the 1980s was dreadful for the Scottish nationalists, and the 1990s too. The Margaret Thatcher had no interest at all in autonomy of any sort for Scotland. And then things got better again, and of course in 1997, a new referendum. 1998, the new Scottish Parliament was established, and since then, well, they almost won the referendum for independence, for God's sake. You know, so that's, it was a good time to be a Scottish nationalist. In Wales, Wales in 1979 voted against a devolved assembly by an overwhelming margin, 80% against. They will also have a new referendum in 1997, which will vote in favour of a new assembly, but by a tiny majority. I think 26% of Welsh electorate vote for an assembly, 50% stay at home, and 24%, this is 1997, and 24% vote against. So it's kind of, yeah, okay then. It's like, would you like an assembly? Oh, all right then. So, however, interestingly enough, once the Welsh Assembly is established, it becomes more popular. That is, the fact that it can be actually there making decisions about health in Wales, separate from England, making decisions about education in Wales and tourism in Wales, it becomes more popular. And there was another referendum a few years later to reinforce the powers of the Welsh Assembly, and they won easily. And so that's something interesting there. A terrible explosion in a mine in Greater Manchester killed a number of people. While the ambassador to the Netherlands, l'ambassadeur britannique aux Pays-Bas, was assassinated along with his servant by the provisional IRA in the Hague. Political assassination, not the most general of the IRA tactics, but it does get used. So there will be a couple more example, very famous examples coming up. Lord Mountbatten, who was killed along with a boy who worked for him, one of his employees. Also Airy Neave, who was actually killed by a car bomb in the House of Commons car park. So this is terrorism in the precise sense of the word. It's not just killing a British political leader; it's doing it in the centre of London. This is part of the tactic. Yeah. James Callaghan's government lost a motion of confidence by one vote, forcing a general election. And the fact that this is the fourth general election in nine years is, of course, a sign of the relative instability of 1970s UK politics. James Callaghan announced that the general election would be held on the 3rd of May. All of the major opinion polls point towards a Conservative win, which would make Margaret Thatcher the first female Prime Minister of Britain. And one of the videos is about that, the night before, the day the government fell. And it's a fascinating video, really, really good one. Yeah, and also it reminds you of a lot of this stuff. But it's also about the very detailed decisions that the Prime Minister had to make. It's an absolutely wonderful documentary. Of course, the documentaries don't mean you must not read books. You must remember that television documentaries are also intended to make good television. Now, the ones on the list I have chosen because they are good, they are nevertheless, television documentaries are usually partisan because that makes good television, you know. It doesn't make good television to say, well, there are many ways of looking at this. Yeah. And so, you know, you can learn a lot from the videos and I recommend them, but, you know, be careful about being as partisan as they are. Yeah. If they say something is obvious, that doesn't mean it necessarily is. So the manifestos are out. Of course, the manifesto, very important things, the manifesto, the Labour Party manifesto is out under the title, The Labour Way is the Better Way. I don't find that a very impressive title, really, because I mean, it's kind of obvious that they think that, isn't it, you know? It's like, it would be worrying if they said the Labour way is the worst way. But there you go, anyway. And the manifesto begins with this paragraph. Now, more than ever, we need Labour's traditional values of cooperation, social justice and fairness. This manifesto restates these Labour principles in an action programme with a strong sense of the future. They appeal to all people, young and old. The world is changing rapidly. New industrial nations are rising to challenge our key industries on which British jobs and living standards depend. The Labour government is taking firm action to equip Britain to adapt to these changes and to seize new opportunities. And we will take care, we will take great care to protect working people and their families from the hardships of change. Well, I've given some examples. You have the car manufacturer who had to sell to Peugeot, the motorcycle factory that just closed down. That's the approach of the Labour Party. So you see that perhaps they are promising a little less this time, yeah, because they've had that. Nevertheless, they promise a wealth tax on people with over 100,000. They also, quite naturally, express pride in the record of their government. They've been the government for 5 years, so they should be able to say some good things we have done, otherwise, you know, nobody will vote for them. So the manifesto boasted of having expanded nursery provision, and they expressed satisfaction that they had built 1.5 million homes and renovated 1 million other homes over 5 years. On the controversial question of selling off council houses, the Labour manifesto does not dare to say we're against it. They think it's too unpopular. So they say, Labour does not oppose the sale of council houses to sitting tenants who want to buy, so long as such sales are at a fair price and do not damage a local authority's ability to meet the demand for decent homes to rent. So they don't like the idea of selling them, but they can't really say they're against it. Yeah. The Conservative Party published their manifesto in response. It began with a very short introduction in a personal style by Margaret Thatcher. The first words went as follows. For me, the heart of politics is not political theory. It is people and how they want to live their lives. Now again, this is the same rhetoric we saw before. It is completely uncontroversial as a sentence. You know, if you take, you know, the most communist of communists, they will never say, "Ah, I don't care about how people live their lives. The most important thing is political theory." It's ridiculous. Yeah. So really, when she's saying that, she's really saying. The Labour Party don't care about you. They're only interested in political theatre. So she doesn't say the word Labour Party, but that's what she's talking about. She's defining herself against the others. No one who has lived in this country during the last 5 years, this is still Margaret Thatcher, yeah? I can't do the voice, can fail to be aware of how the balance of our society has been increasingly tilted in favour of the state at the expense of individual freedom. This election may be the last chance we have to reverse that process. Okay, so a certain melodrama. It is therefore the most crucial election since the war. This Conservative manifesto, published at a time when opinion polls very much favoured the Conservatives, had a confident and even at times aggressive tone. A long section spoke of proposed reforms to trade unions to make strikes more difficult. And these reforms will be introduced, but very slowly, one at once, from 1980 to 1992. I think that this is one of the articles I put on my blog as well. I think there are five different laws about trade unions, because there are 13 million of them. You don't want Margaret Thatcher did not want them all to be unhappy the same day. Because 13 million is too many to be all unhappy the same day. On housing, it was made clear in the Conservative manifesto that obliging local councils to sell council houses to the tenants was a major policy priority. The Conservative proposed that council houses be sold for a third to a half less than market prices. The Conservative manifesto also presented the Conservatives as more pro-Europe than Labour were. Back on the streets of London in April 1979, There was a demonstration between a clash between a National Front demonstration and an anti-Nazi League demonstration. And a teacher, an anti-Nazi League protester, Blair Peach, died after being struck on the head by a member of the police. Blair Peach was a member of the Socialist Workers' Party and had been organising a campaign before the demonstration against a pub which refused to serve black people. And that's very interesting at this particular time in 1978. So of course, it's illegal to refuse to serve black people, but there were still pubs who did. Because it's very complicated to, you know, get proof and get the right people to go to the right tribunal. And also, some black people didn't want to go to the courts because they felt it didn't feel safe. So a very interesting thing. This was a very significant, it's obviously a tragic death. But the fact that a white protester should be killed by trying to fight against racism had a tremendous effect on the black organisations active against racism in Britain, who had sometimes been tempted by the idea that white people are not interested in fighting racism. Not always an unreasonable assumption in the 1970s, it has to be said. And Lyndon Kwesi Johnson, who is an extremely well-known sort of hip-hop poet, or pre-hip-hop poet, wrote in his honour the piece Reggae for Peach. It's a best-selling reggae kind of chant. In honour of Blair Peach was considered to be really something. Today, a primary school in South London is named after Blair Peach. In any case, on the day of the election, 76% of registered voters turned out to vote, and the Conservative Party obtained a 43-seat majority. I don't have the popular votes here, but it's a matter of those few percent, yeah? That when you win with a 43, but they probably got, 48% and the Labour Party 43%. I don't know the figures actually, but it'd be something like that, yeah. And then the smaller parties get the rest. The Liberal Party did slightly less well than in 1974. They got just under 14%. Oh, and yes, and this is the moment that Liberal Party ex-leader Jeremy Thorpe went on trial. And I have here the dates. The first Member of Parliament to publicly declare he was homosexual was in 1984, and the first Conservative, 2002. Okay, which I think is quite significant. So what did Margaret Thatcher do as soon as she arrived in power? Well, I can't tell you everything she did as soon as she arrived in power, but one of the things is they abolished the Prices Commission. The Prices Commission had been established in 1973 to try to establish some government control over price increases, whereas the Thatcherite opinion was that markets should deal with this, that the government intervention was not appropriate. And Margaret Thatcher proposed to privatise important parts of nationalised industry. Very conscious of the importance of persuading the population of the justice of privatisation, the government presented it as taking the nationalised industries away from the bureaucracy and giving them back to the people. In this spirit, the British Gas shares, for example, would be sold off mostly to individual small shareholders. This was very important because the government wanted to privatise, but politically, if they had sold it to McDonald's or to IBM or some big multinational, that would not look so good politically. And so what they did is they said, we are selling shares for British Gas, but no individual can have more than 200. So you see, we are taking this company away from the bureaucrats and giving it to individuals of the British people. So this is, it's a form of populism in a way. Now, the individuals of the British people bought £200 worth and 3 months later sold it for £500. And the multinationals had all those shares. It's only a matter of time, but it was important politically. So it shows that, again, that even something like nationalisation, which the government can decide to nationalise because they want to, nevertheless, they have to be careful because they want it to look good politically. Because even if they've got a good majority, it's only 4 or 5 years till the next election. Yeah. And that's a short time, well, in some ways it's a short time in politics. I mean, people lead parties because they think that over the next 20, 30 years, transformations in society under my party will be better for the society. And so if I'm just irresponsible to do all the things I want and then lose 5 years later, well, that's a failure, really. Although I think it's Edward Heath who said, all political careers end in failure. The only way not to have your political career end in failure is to die young, I guess, you know. There's always something going there. There were also the first direct elections to the European Parliament, but only 32% of the British voted. 61% in France, 66% in Germany. Anybody would think that the British were not enthusiastic about the European Union. I think that was always the case, and of course it eventually led to the recent decisions. The first budget of the new government reduced income tax, in particular for the higher incomes, and increased VAT. I explained how this was a reduction in the redistributive function of taxation. And that's about it, because I don't have much time. The only events which I must mention, which I didn't manage to mention, is that Pink Floyd released their album The Wall, their 11th album, The Wall, a rock opera following the troubled life of a young boy. And somebody else released an important album also in 1979. The Gang of Four released their debut album, Entertainment, including a series of sarcastic anti-love songs such as Love'll Get You Like a Dose of Anthrax, which is very typical of the punk. And that takes us to not quite the end of 1979, but I think really the end of the period is the Conservative election and the first few things the Conservative did. And that's all I have time for, and that's only because they said at the beginning, they said, you have 15 hours. Now, frankly, I could have done 45, no problem. But you know, it's a matter of money. Yeah? They don't have the money to have more. Some universities have more, some universities have less. Yeah? I have a colleague. Somebody said they have 10 hours. You know, which is it's a joke, really. Anyway, we still have 8 more. Thanks to the aggregation and town sharing them to for us later on. And I'll see most of you tomorrow morning for the TEM course. Thank you for your attention.